the beginning. It's got the potential to be a real beauty. Inviting him inside would be stretching my depleted supply of manners entirely too far. Being nice had netted me misery beyond description. Besides, I'd already been nice enough to leave my cousins alive that day. Plus, the prissy little bimbo down at the bank still had all her blonde hair and not a mark on her face. That was enough nice for one day. I stopped at the door. "I'm glad to hear it, Billy Lee. Come around in a few days when I've had a chance to think, and we'll talk about it." He nodded. "My phone number is on the refrigerator. Let me know when you want me to go to work. I'll outline what I've got in mind for the exterior. I think we can make this look like it did in its heyday. I'm glad to have you for a neighbor, Trudy." He whistled as he left. I wanted to slap him. No one should be happy when my world was in shambles. Not one thing had changed since the last time I'd walked through the front door of Aunt Gert's house. Every square inch of the place was covered in mismatched furniture and cheap collectibles. Every table sported a lamp sitting on a crocheted doily. None of the lamps were plugged in, because there were very few electrical outlets. Ceramic ducks, cows, and lots of birds surrounded the lamps. Chairs and sofas had mismatched hand towels pinned to the backs and washcloths on the arms. I walked right past it all without even a shudder. Whoever said that a person, especially an overweight one, could live for weeks with no food, had rocks for brains. I was about to join the ranks of the recently departed if I didn't find something to put into my mouth. When I reached the kitchen, I was amazed at the contents of the refrigerator. Milk, still inside the expiration date. Lunch meat. A whole loaf of bread. Lettuce, tomatoes, cheese. Real mayonnaise that was even my favorite brand. I made a sandwich, devoured it, and made another. I finished the second one and had a tall glass of milk before I went out to the car to get the paperwork. I carried it to the house and wondered why Aunt Gert had let things go to rot and ruin with all that money in the bank. I climbed the stairs and laid the papers on the bed in the guest room, where I planned to sleep that night. The second floor had three bedrooms and a bathroom. When the house had been built, the bathroom was down the back path toward the rear of the lot. According to Mama, the family modernized the place after her grandfather died. The heat was oppressive, so I opened a window and begged for a breeze. But there wasn't a bit of wind between me and the Gulf of Mexico. The sweat pouring off me had as much to do with nerves as the weather. A cool shower might keep me from melting into a puddle of lard on the floor. I opened the bathroom door and almost cried. The wall-hung sink was listing to the front. The toilet was crazed and cracked. The tub was as old as God and pitted. There was no shower above it. This would definitely be the first place I started when Billy Lee and I sat down to talk about remodeling. When I finished bathing, I wrapped a towel around my body and wandered through the other rooms. Aunt Gert's bedroom was cluttered with more stuff than the rest of the house, knick-knacks and old pictures. The guest room, where I'd left my paperwork, was clean, but smelled unused and slightly musty. Then there was Uncle Lonnie's room, with a padlock on the outside. I didn't remember there being a lock on the door the last time I was in the house, but then that was probably back when Lonnie was still alive. Why had Aunt Gert closed up the room, and how long had it been locked? Aunt Gert was a few inches taller than I, but her elastic waist jeans and shirts fit me fairly well. The nightgowns in her dresser drawer looked inviting, but it wasn't time for bed. I had a lot of reading to do to understand what all Aunt Gert had left behind. I dressed in a pair of Aunt Gert's pants and a faded T-shirt, made a pot of coffee, and sat down at the kitchen table to read through all of the paperwork. But the lock on that bedroom door kept bugging me. Why had she put a padlock on the outside of a bedroom? What was in there that she needed to protect? I sighed and tried to mentally rehearse what I would say to Drew when he got back to town, but my curiosity got the better of me. I went to the foyer table where I'd tossed the keys Billy Lee had given me. Sure enough, there was a padlock key on the ring. No chilly air brushed past me as Lonnie's ghost left the room when I opened the door. Nothing jumped out from under the bed to scare me. The hair didn't stand up on my arms, nor did any scary music play in my head. It looked exactly as I remembered from back when I was a little girl, which was completely out of place. All the other rooms in the house were filled with junk, but this room was stark and plain, with a nightstand on each side of a full-sized bed. No knick-knacks anywhere. A calendar, dated the year he had died back in the 90s, was the only thing hanging on the walls. Plain white curtains framed the single window overlooking the front yard. A rocking chair, with a worn red plaid pad in the seat, stood nearby. Uncle Lonnie's polyester pants and jackets still hung in the closet, along with cotton shirts. His wing-tipped shoes and bedroom slippers lined up neatly on the floor. The room was spotless. Not even one lonesome old dust bunny hiding under the bed. Why would Aunt Gert clean the room on a regular basis, and then put a padlock on the outside? But just in case there was a ghost in there that only came out at a certain time, I snapped the padlock shut when I left. By the time I got back downstairs, the phone was ringing. "What the devil are you doing?" Marty asked when I answered it. "Taking a look at my inheritance," I answered. "I don't mean that. Why were you in town looking worse than the garbage collector?" "That is none of your business." "Drew is going to kill you. I heard you went into the bank and made a big withdrawal from his accounts and then went to the other bank to deposit it. Is that true?" I stretched the phone cord, but it wouldn't reach to the kitchen, so I couldn't see if there was any rat poison under the sink. "Doesn't the town have anything else to talk about today? They could be discussing dear old Aunt Gert."
"It's your funeral they're going to be discussing when Drew comes home."
"I'm sure you and Betsy will console him after he kills me. Maybe you can make him some hot chicken salad like Lori Lou did." Dead silence on the other end of the phone line. "Are you still there, Marty?"
"What are you talking about?"
"He might not be too choosy, especially if the affair with Charity goes south. And it will. She'll get tired of him. Maybe you can make him some hot chicken salad, and he'll buy you a new car. I think you have to be about Crystal's age to get a Thunderbird. But then I might be wrong." Nothing felt better than listening to her gasp when I hung up the phone. Chapter 3. "They've been talking about you," Mama whispered when I stopped at the nursing home on my way to Durant the next morning. I'd slept poorly. Different house, different bed. I needed it to be a good day with Mama. "Who has?" I asked. "You know who. They said you moved into Gert's house. She's dead, you know. She won't be there to keep you company."
"I know, Mama. I went to her funeral yesterday, and she left me the house. I'm going to remodel it and live there."
We were sitting in the little garden behind the nursing home. A dove flew up, alit on the low branches of a tree, and cocked its gray head toward us. The thermometer on the side of the porch post that morning had read 85 degrees, and the weatherman had said it would be in the high 90s before the day was finished. A soft, warm breeze flowed through the garden, and Mama lifted her head to catch the sun's rays. She still had a lovely complexion,
And the home's beautician kept her hair dyed the same shade of dark brown that she'd had when she was a young woman. Her eyes were the same shade as Crystal's, that lovely summer sky blue. She was a perfect size 4 before she married Daddy, and she'd maintained that size all her life. When she brought her chin down, her eyes had gone blank. Past, present, and future would be mixed up together as if she'd tossed them into a blender and pushed the puree button. She whispered, "Gert should have known better than to marry that Lonnie. 40 is too old to be a bride, and him 10 years younger? He wants her money. But she's a smart girl, that Gert is." "Nice warm morning," Lassie said as she sat down in a chair next to Mama. Her back was as straight as it had been when she was 15, and her hair boasted very little gray. Mama smiled at Lassie. "It is, isn't it? Did you know that Gert died and left Trudy her house? Trudy was married at one time, but her husband died. She keeps a lock on his bedroom door. I never figured out why, but she does." Lassie sat down beside Mama and winked at me. "Yes, I was sorry that Gert died. Marty also told us you've moved into her house." "Marty was here?" I was amazed. Lassie nodded. "Last night. Came to see about a job. This place needs an activities director. Someone to fix up a party once a month and help us old codgers paint flower pots. Your mother and I were sitting in the lounge watching a rerun of The Golden Girls. That one where Blanche's daddy dies and she gets crossways with her sister and won't go to the funeral. Marty stopped and visited for a minute on her way out. I think she was too late. They hired someone yesterday morning." Lassie's mind was still good, but she had diabetes, congestive heart failure, arthritis, and a whole host of other physical problems. Mama's little body was in perfect shape, but Alzheimer's had robbed her of her mind. "Blanche was sorry she didn't go to Big Daddy's funeral. I'm sorry I didn't go to Drew's funeral, but I never liked that man. I might have spit in his dead face," Mama said seriously. "Mama, you always loved Drew," I reminded her. "I'm a good pretender." She shot me a puzzled look. "Who are you?" "I'm waiting for Trudy. She'll be home from school for lunch soon. I'm making her grilled cheese sandwiches and real fried potatoes." She turned to Lassie. "Are you the new maid? If you are, then be sure and clean the toilet better than you did last week." Lassie took her arm. "Yes, ma'am, I am the new maid. You come on with me, and we'll go look at that toilet right now." She whispered to me, "I'll get her back to her room. Tomorrow might be a better day." "I hope so," I said. "Glad to hear you're going to live in Gert's house. There ain't no use in talking about the reason you made that decision. Just get on with your life. You're still young and pretty." At 90 plus, Lassie would probably classify any almost 40-year-old woman as young and pretty. But I appreciated the compliment. I hit a button that opened the back door into the activities and physical therapy room, and we all three filed into the nursing home. Lassie and Mama slowly made their way across the room and down the hall to the right. I went on through the visitor's lounge and punched in the code to open the front door, only to find that the code had been changed. A nurse's aide came along and poked in the right numbers to let me out. While she pushed the buttons, I checked my reflection in the door glass. I hardly recognized the woman looking back at me. She wore Aunt Gert's jeans rolled up at the hems and a t-shirt with a sequined butterfly across the chest. A few sequins had long since flown away in the Oklahoma wind, but several hanging threads gave testimony to the fact that they'd once sparkled there. Her long brown hair was tied back in a ponytail at the nape of her neck with a red silk scarf, and her green eyes looked tired.
I rather liked the new strange woman in the glass, even with the tired eyes. But it wasn't any wonder that Mama hadn't recognized me.
Thank you, I told the aide.
She smiled. You're welcome. Your mother is a sweetheart. I love her style. I just wish she had more good days. Even when she doesn't know any of us, she still looks like a fashion queen. You do well keeping her all dolled up, she said.
I could have hugged the woman. Thank you for noticing. You have a nice day.
You too, she said, as the door closed between us. When I opened the car, a blast of heat hit me in the face, blowing strands of hair to stick to my cheeks and forehead. It didn't take long to get the engine going, the air conditioner running full speed, and to decide that I was cutting my hair. The only reason I had kept it long was for Drew. I drove through Milburn, Emmett, and Nida, which was basically a church and a few scattered homes. Then it was on to Durant. The idea of stopping to talk to Crystal about her decision to get married on the sly did cross my mind. But I had a war to fight with her father, and I couldn't do battle on two fronts at once. When I arrived at Walmart, there was no waiting line in the beauty shop. I waltzed in, hopped up into a chair, and pointed to a picture on the wall of a young girl with too much eyeshadow and bright red lipstick. She wore black leather and looked like a rock star. I want it all cut off like that. The hairdresser flipped a plastic cape around my shoulders.
Are you sure?
Absolutely. Only don't leave so much on the sides. Cut it above my ears. I want to be able to wash it and go. I'm sick of straightening irons and blow dryers.
You have a lot of curl for that cut. It's going to kink up all over your head.
And I'm going to love it. I wore it like that in high school.
She removed the red silk scarf and brushed out a tangled mess of long, frizzy curls. Why did you let it grow long?
Because my husband liked long hair.
She giggled. Fighting with him, are you?
No, but I'm going to be very soon.
I flinched when she gathered up my long hair and laid the scissors to it. Want to change your mind?
No. Cut it off. In 20 minutes, it was short and kinky. My head felt lighter than it had in years. Too bad my heart was still a heavy chunk of rock in my chest. I paid the woman and added a tip, found a shopping cart, and was headed toward the clothing section when I heard my daughter's voice.
Mother, what have you done?
Crystal gasped.
I had my hair cut. What do you think?
Daddy is going to have a fit. He hates your hair short. That's why your senior picture isn't hanging in the hallway. I'm not coming home to visit you two until you grow it out again.
The battle had arrived whether I was ready or not. It was either fight or slink into a corner, and I was tired of that business.
Too bad, then. I'm keeping it this way forever.
Her nose wrinkled up in disgust.
And your clothes? You look like Aunt Gert.
That's because these used to belong to Aunt Gert. I missed you at the funeral yesterday. My daughter wore a cute little pair of jean shorts, a Vegas t-shirt, and fancy sandals, and she carried a purse that likely would have cost half of my teacher's aide paycheck. Her light brown hair had been recently cut and highlighted with blonde streaks.
Was that yesterday? I wouldn't have come even if I'd remembered. I hate funerals. But why are you wearing her clothes?
You got time to have lunch with me? I'll tell you all about it. When opportunity knocks, you don't leave it standing on the doorstep. You invite it in and feed it chocolate cake. That's what Aunt Gert used to say.
She blushed. No, I've got... Actually, I'm just picking up some shampoo and conditioner and...
Oh, don't get your panties into a wad. I know you and Jonah went to Vegas and got married. I don't like it, but evidently my opinion doesn't matter.
She tilted her head up and looked down her aristocratic nose at me. I can't have this conversation now. Me either. I've got underwear to buy. I'm at Aunt Gert's. No, I can't say that anymore. I'm at my house. But it's still listed under Gertrude Martin in the phone book. Call that number if you need me. I pushed my cart around her. She grabbed the cart and glared at me, those pretty blue eyes flashing enough anger to light up the whole Walmart store.
You're going to tell me right now what is going on.
I gave the cart a jerk. I'm not having this conversation here. If you want to talk, you can come to lunch with me. Otherwise, run along and buy your shampoo. We'll discuss it another day. I left her digging in her purse for her cell phone, no doubt to call her father. But right then, she could have been tattling to St. Peter and I wouldn't have cared. On my way to buy underwear, I passed the window air conditioners, hauled the cheapest one down off the shelf, and set it into my cart. I'd be cool in the guest bedroom at night until central heat and air conditioning was installed. Billy Lee would most likely tell me the whole place had to be rewired before we could think about something that luxurious. Cato's dress shop was located next to Walmart. A few minutes in there netted me a couple of dresses to wear to church. A bright red one with a parrot embroidered on the hem and across the back of the jacket, and a more subdued canary yellow with a Hawaiian print short-sleeved jacket. No more black silk for this girl. Lessie had said I was young and pretty. Besides, look what expensive black suits had gotten me. A husband who cheated with girls who wore bright colors. I bought red leather slides with kitten heels and a pair of cute little flats in hot pink that matched a flower in the Hawaiian print. I wasn't slinking into church the next day. The old Trudy had died in the church bathroom. She was now a new woman who didn't need to be poor anymore or have her heart blessed either. That's when I saw a beautiful hot pink hat. It would provide the crowning glory to my new outfit, so I bought it too. I wouldn't have noticed the rack of capri-length bibbed overalls if there hadn't been a line at the checkout counter. I found two pair in size 16 and grabbed a couple of sleeveless tank tops to wear under them. One orange and one turquoise. It was 2 o'clock when I got back to Tishomingo, and I hadn't had anything to eat since breakfast. I whipped into the Sonic and ordered a foot-long hot dog with chili and cheese and a side order of tater tots. I rolled down the windows and ate in the car rather than taking the food home. When I pulled up under the carport in the backyard, Billy Lee was coming through the opening in the hedge with a notebook in his hands. I took a long look at the house and seriously contemplated buying a box of dynamite, blasting the place, and letting it rain pieces all over town. Then I'd cash in all those assets Aunt Gert had left me and disappear off to a beach with white sand and no cellular service. That way I wouldn't have to have a conversation with Drew, Crystal, my cousins, or Billy Lee.
Hey.
Billy Lee's pale blue eyes lit up. He stopped beside the car and flipped open his notebook on the hood.
So you're ready to see my ideas?
I guess I am. I looked at the air conditioner in the back seat and longed for a cool breeze. The wind blows constantly in Oklahoma until the first day of June, and then a body can't buy, borrow, or steal a gust of it until after Labor Day. That's because it's so hot in June, July, and August that any amount of wind would cook the flesh off our bones. Daddy used to say that even the lizards carried canteens over one shoulder and a machine gun over the other during the summer months. The machine gun was to take out anyone who looked sideways at the water jugs. Billy Lee nodded toward the house as he pointed to his drawings.
The way I see it is that we have someone come in first and redo all the windows. They're older than Methuselah, and we need central heat and air. All that bought air will escape out those old wooden sashes. I've got some estimates here on new ones that open to the inside for easy cleaning, and will still keep the look of the house.
He already had that we business down pat.
I forgot all about Dynamite when he flipped a few pages and showed me a before and after picture in a brochure of a house where that kind of windows had been installed. He had my undivided attention after that.
While the window people are here, the electricians can be rewiring the whole place and getting it ready for air conditioning. I see you've got one of those little units in your back seat. Guess that's for your bedroom. You'll have to run an extension cord from the outlet attached to the light fixture in the ceiling, since there are no plugs on the walls in any of the upstairs rooms. Gert had one put in the kitchen so she could hook up a microwave. The rest of the house is wired only for lighting.
Good grief. I was glad I'd had my hair cut. I would have had to unplug the microwave every morning to plug in my hair straightener.
If you'll trust me to get the ball rolling, I can probably get things started on Monday morning.
Fine, I agreed. With one word, I had just put my trust in Billy Lee. After I'd vowed never to trust another man for anything.
While they're working on that, I'll start rebuilding the front porch. It's a wonder Gert didn't fall through those rotten boards. And all the gingerbread around the eaves and dormers needs to be removed and stripped of all that nasty peeling paint and refinished. You'll need to decide what colors you want to use on the house and the trim while I get it ready to paint. Hopefully we'll get all that done by fall, and then we'll begin on the inside. That'll give you lots of time to clean it out. By the way, why are you living here without your husband?
I want the house a soft yellow and all the trim white, like it was in the beginning. I want to take out the wall between the living room and dining room and make it airy and light. I want a new bathroom upstairs, so we will need a plumber. And I want a bathroom put in downstairs. Part of the back porch off the kitchen can be turned into a bathroom, can't it? And I'm divorcing my husband, Billy Lee.
Sorry if I stepped on sore toes. You sure you want to move in here?
Very, very sure.
Want me to carry that air conditioner upstairs and get it running for you?
I could have kissed the man right between his pretty blue eyes. Billy Lee had simply accepted my decision and moved on. And everyone thought he was an odd duck. He picked up the air conditioner box as if it was a feather pillow and started into the house.
Tomorrow's church. Shall we begin the work the next day?
I carried my other bags and opened the door for him. I'd like that. He found a long brown extension cord in a kitchen drawer, laid it on top of the air conditioner box, carried both upstairs, and plugged the cord into an apparatus with a plug on each side that was screwed into the light bulb socket. He weaved the cord around the end of the iron bedstead, under the throw rug on the hardwood floor, and over to the window. In minutes, cool air blew into the room.
Keep the door shut and this room will cool down by bedtime. I've got a rack of ribs smoking for supper. Dinner at 6.
My expression must have been scary, odd, or plain crazy, because he threw up his hands in defense.
What's the matter? Did I say something wrong? Do you hate ribs? I used to bring Gert food all the time.
Evidently, I'd taken Gert's place in the scheme of things. As the wife of a small-town lawyer, I'd been at the top of the social ladder. But now, I was on the same level as crazy old Aunt Gert. That deflated my ego as much as the news in the ladies' room had. No, Billy Lee. You didn't say anything wrong. I'd love to have ribs for supper. Thank you.
Good. I'll go on home and check on them. They're in the smoker. I'll be here at 6 then.
I nodded. He closed the door behind him. I plopped down onto the bed and enjoyed the wonderful cold air flowing over my body. After a while, I flipped over onto my stomach. That's when I saw the old wooden jewelry box sitting on the nightstand. I rolled off the bed and picked it up. It was heavy enough that it could have been holding gold nuggets. And after my bank trip, nothing would surprise me. I opened it carefully. It was brimful of gorgeous jewelry that I'd never seen Gert wear, and that surely hadn't come from a dollar store. I picked up a brooch shaped like a daisy with a long golden stem. The petals were white, elongated opals. The center, a lovely golden topaz of at least 3 carats. I flipped it over to find a date written on a tiny piece of masking tape attached to the back. June 3rd, 1958. That would have been a year after she'd married Uncle Lonnie. Why hadn't she ever worn this lovely piece? A beautiful heart-shaped pendant was the next thing I pulled out. The diamonds around its outer edge sparkled in the light. The single dangling diamond in the middle was a carat or maybe more. It was dated August 1959. Uncle Lonnie had died the year Drew and I married, and there was a piece for every year up until then. Why had he given Gert one costly piece of jewelry a year, and why hadn't she worn any of them? They couldn't be anniversary presents, because they'd married in June of 1957, and not all the dates on the jewelry were in June. She'd told me at my wedding, which was also in June, that she'd married in the same month, and that I was not to expect a happily ever after marriage, just because I'd chosen that most traditional month to marry. I scattered the jewelry on the bed all around me. The topaz and opal pin looked familiar. I'd seen one like it before. But where? I picked it up, and then it dawned on me. Daisy Black wore one pinned to the lapel of a black suit almost every Sunday. Why would Aunt Gert and Daisy have identical fancy brooches? I untangled a pendant with a fine gold chain and looked at the diamond cross and remembered that Patsy Banner had had one like it. She had died a couple of years ago and had passed it down to her daughter Loretta, who wore it all the time to remember her mother. A square-cut emerald ring caught my attention. As I laid it back in the box, I noticed the corner of something sticking out from the felt bottom. It was a certificate for the diamond pendant from a famous jewelry store in Oklahoma City. What a mystery. Either Uncle Lonnie Martin had purchased the necklace for Gert, and she'd been too mean-spirited to ever wear it, or she had bought the jewelry for herself and maybe kept it a secret from Lonnie. If the designer was still living, the jewelry store that sold it could probably tell me something about the pieces. Finding the jeweler took a little longer than typing the address into the laptop I'd left behind with all my other belongings, but the telephone operator finally located it for me. The phone rang twice before a nice voice asked if she could be of assistance. "Hello, this is Trudy Williams. I've just inherited several pieces of jewelry from my aunt, Gertrude Martin." "Just a minute, ma'am. You'll need to speak to my husband. Please hold on while I transfer you to his office." A deep voice promptly answered,
"Hello, Mrs. Williams. My name is Paul Fisher. I understand you have inherited a collection of jewelry from your aunt. I wasn't even aware that Gert had passed on. Please accept my condolences."
"You knew Gert?" I was amazed.
"Oh, yes. I only met her once, but we've talked several times on the phone. I've been trying to buy back those pieces ever since Lonnie died. It's the only complete set of my work. Name your price."
"Mr. Fisher, I know of at least 2 more pieces you designed right here in Tishomingo. 2 different women each own a piece exactly like these," I said.
"Yes, they do. There are 37 pieces in all, and I made 2 of each design. But Gert had the only complete set."
"Why did Gert have them all, and these other women have 1 each?
"Because Lonnie had 2 pieces done each time he came in. I didn't ask questions. I was here to design and sell jewelry."
"That rat. I changed my mind about Gert."
"Could be. I didn't ask what he did with the 2 pieces when he walked out of here. I just knew that after Lonnie died, Gert came here toting a wooden box with all that jewelry and asked me what it was worth. I made her a generous offer, but she laughed at me. Every year I beg, and every year she tells me the same thing.
Which is?
Verbatim.
That would be nice.
I'll keep these until I die. The world is going to the devil in a handbasket. These will keep me and my family from starving. So, are you selling?
Not today. But if I decide to, I won't sell to anyone else. You've got my word.
If it's as good as Gert's word, then that's all I need. Call me when you get ready to give them up.
A cuckoo clock in the living room clicked 6 times, and Billy Lee knocked on the door at the same time I hung up the telephone. When I opened it, he was standing there with a container of food.
Supper time, he said.
Have you eaten? Crimson flooded his cheeks.
No, me and Gert always ate together.
Then bring it in. I've got sweet tea in the fridge.
Gert and I ate in the kitchen on the bar. Is that all right with you?
He followed me through the living room and dining room and into the kitchen. How did Gert stand you? You're too nice to get along with her.
He squared his shoulders and set his jaw. I'm not always nice. I speak my opinion. I just didn't want to offend you on your first day here.
I'm not going to be nice all the time, and I don't want you to be. I'd rather have honest than nice. So we'll always speak our minds. Deal? I stuck out my right hand.
Deal.
He set the food on the counter and shook. He opened the plastic containers, and I popped ice out of those old aluminum trays that have a handle on top, filled 2 glasses, and added tea. The aroma of barbecue and baked beans filled the kitchen, and my mouth began to water. He opened cabinet doors and removed 2 plates, took out silverware from a drawer, and pulled the paper napkin holder over to the middle of the breakfast bar.
Dig in, he said.
The ribs had just the right blend of smoke and sauce. The baked beans had been slow simmered until they were thick, and the biscuits were light and fluffy. Tell me something, I said between bites.
Long, slow cooking over a low flame.
No, not about supper. This is better than a 5-star restaurant's food, and you ought to run a barbecue joint. But that's not what I wanted to know. Do you know much about the relationship between Uncle Lonnie and Aunt Gert? He shook his head.
I was off at college when Lonnie died. I didn't know Gert really well until after that. She didn't talk much about him. Matter of fact, the only time we talked about Lonnie was a couple of years ago. I was helping her with some plumbing and noticed the padlock on that door up there.
What did she say?
She said that what was in the past was best left there, and that talking about it was like stirring a fresh cow pile with a wooden spoon. Didn't accomplish a thing, and only made the stink and the flies worse, and the spoon useless for anything else. Then we came downstairs and had a beer and talked about the new president. His inauguration was on television.
You remember exactly what you talked about? I asked, amazed. He shrugged.
Sure. I'd stepped on her toes pretty badly, so I remember it well. Gert was a fine old girl.
What else is this old place going to tell me? He smiled, and his whole face lit up.
Whatever it is, I hope you like it.
The phone rang, so I dashed off to the foyer table where the ancient blue object was located. I hoped it was Crystal, but the minute I picked up the receiver, Drew started yelling, "Have you gone as crazy as your mother, woman? I'll be home on Monday, and you'd better have a good excuse for what you've done. Why did you take all that money out of the bank?" "I'm not having this conversation right now." I hung up on him. The phone rang again immediately. I picked the receiver up. "I took the money out of the bank and buried it in the backyard under Aunt Gert's apricot tree. I left 2 bits in the accounts for your newest fling. I'm having supper with a friend, so leave me alone."
Drew was yelling and cussing as I hung up on him. I made a mental note to ask the phone company about getting caller ID when they came to add a jack to every room. I returned to the kitchen and loaded another helping of barbecue onto my plate.
Hey, I forgot to tell you this afternoon. I love your new haircut. It looks just like it did when we were in high school,
Billy Lee said. Thank you. I smiled, and it felt dang good that he remembered.
Was that Drew?
Yes.
Want to talk about it?
No.
Then we won't.
I'd never appreciated a person as much as I did Billy Lee right then.
Chapter 4. I'd never been claustrophobic in my life until I shut the bedroom door the second night. Every knick-knack in the room seemed to stare at me with those never-closing eyes. Shelves were covered with everything from cats to elephants waiting for me to shut my eyes so they could come alive like in a sci-fi movie. Poorly painted ceramic ducks on the windowsills had cacti growing out of the holes in their backs. I imagined them jumping off the sills and throwing cactus needles at me like porcupines. The cold breeze from the air conditioner caused the wooden thread spool attached to the end of the light cord to sway. Would the menagerie of glass-eyed critters blink and begin to breathe if I yanked on the cord? Why was I suddenly afraid to turn off the light? A little introspection said it wasn't all that junk that bothered me, but the fact that Drew was coming home in 2 days. We'd never fought. Not one time. I'd figured out early how to keep him happy and made a full-time job of it. The wind-up clock beside the bed sounded a tick-tock warning in sing-song fashion. Drew is coming home. You are dead. You will never out-argue a lawyer. He'll talk you into going back with him. Yes, he will. I vowed that the next morning, the animals and the clock were all going to the dumpster or Goodwill. It was their last night to look at me with black enameled eyes and evil little smirks on their faces, or for the clock to tick out a message. I was in charge of my future, and Drew wasn't going to win, lawyer or not. I pulled the cord, but all the dark did was bring on acute insomnia. I tossed and turned, and finally groped around for the cord and turned the lights back on. All the animals were exactly where they'd been, and Drew was still coming home. I went to the kitchen and had a cookie. That led to another cookie and a glass of milk. While I was pouring the milk, I dropped the jug and drenched the front of my nightgown. I cleaned up the mess, then went back upstairs to find another nightgown in Aunt Gert's dresser. I pushed aside the flannel gowns looking for a cotton summer one and found a manila envelope addressed to Gert. The jewelry box had taught me not to throw anything away unexamined, so I carried the envelope to my bedroom. I removed my wet gown, put on the fresh one, and crawled into the middle of the bed. The envelope was dated the previous March, and the postmark said it had come from Hollis, Oklahoma. The return address label had Harriet Stemmons on it, but the handwriting was big and masculine. I turned the envelope upside down, and letters tumbled out in front of me. Aunt Gert's precise, small handwriting on the outside of the letters addressed them to either Harriet O'Brien or Harriet Stemmons. A single sheet of paper among them explained that Harriet had prized their friendship and had kept a few of the letters she had received through the years. But Harriet had passed on the month before, and the sender was now returning those letters to Gertrude. He hoped she'd enjoy remembering all the good times they'd had when they were the two new teachers in the Milburn school system, and the letters they'd shared since then. The letter was signed Thomas O'Brien, Harriet's son. I shuffled them into order by date and opened the one dated December 10th, 1944. In it, Aunt Gert wrote about riding a horse 9 miles each day so she wouldn't have to use her gas ration stamps. She mentioned her sister, who would have been my grandmother, and then told Harriet how much she missed her beau, Miles, who was fighting in the war. It was hard to think that Aunt Gert had ever been that young or happy, but there it was on the page. One letter turned into 2, 3, and 4, until I'd read all of them. Gert didn't go into much detail, but there was a splotch that looked like a teardrop on the letter she wrote saying that Miles had died in the war and that she'd never marry. Letter number 12 was dated May of 1957, and she was almost giddy. She was in love and she was going to be married. He worked at the local Chevrolet dealership and was 10 years younger than she. She hoped that in the near future she and Lonnie Martin would make a road trip to western Oklahoma to visit Harriet and Rick. Number 13, written in December of 1957, was a very different letter. Gert's tone had changed drastically. She apologized to Harriet for not writing since the wedding, but confessed that the marriage had been a very big mistake. The 14th letter was the one that caused my eyes to pop wide open. It was dated June of 1958, a year after she'd married Lonnie. It started out, "Dear Harriet, I made a mistake. If I could figure out a way to kill my husband, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But I'm stuck with him until he dies. He married me because he thought I had money, and he's cheating on me. And the crazy thing is, most of the women he goes after are my friends. Daisy Black and I were friends from the time we were just little girls. And now, she's sleeping with my husband. He even gave her a fancy piece of jewelry, just like the one he gave me. I saw her wearing it at church and knew immediately what was going on. When I confronted him, he laughed in my face and said that when I gave him access to all my money instead of a monthly allowance, he'd stop giving his mistress the same jewelry he gave me. Until then, I could expect to see lots of jewelry just like mine in Tishomingo. If I divorce him, he'll get at least half my property. What am I to do? If I toss him out, everyone will think I was just a silly old woman who played into the hands of a con artist. If I don't, I'll be miserable. I wish I'd never married him." I took a deep breath. It's a wonder the man lived another 30 years. No wonder she'd grown bitter. I yawned twice and turned off the light. A full moon filtered in through the lace curtains, and I thought about Lonnie's spirit being locked up in the room across the hall. If I heard chains rattling in Uncle Lonnie's old room, I was hightailing it out of that house and buying dynamite the next morning. I had just shut my eyes when I heard a sound like a freight train headed right toward my pillow. How on earth the train had jumped the tracks in Ravia and made it 5 miles to Tishomingo was a mystery. But clearly it was on Broadway Street and coming on strong. I sat up so fast it made me dizzy, and I tried to jump out of bed, but my legs were tangled up in the sheets. My life flashed before my eyes as I got ready for the impact. If I died, Drew would automatically get everything Aunt Gert had left me. I'd rather suffer the wrath of Lucifer than Aunt Gert in those circumstances. I hit the floor in a run and made it to the door when I realized it wasn't a train, but Gert's alarm clock, which I'd set the night before so I wouldn't be late to church. The cursed thing had 2 bells on the top and no volume button. It took me several minutes to find the off button on the back, and the silence did nothing to stop the ringing in my ears. I grabbed the clock and slung it against the far wall, but it kept ticking. I kicked it like a soccer ball against another wall, and it still kept ticking. I picked it up and marched downstairs, out the back door, and to the garage. The cursed thing was not going to live to ring another day. The noise it made when it hit the concrete floor was pitiful, but still not enough to kill it. Until that moment, I hadn't known that inanimate objects could be immortal. I searched for something to use to destroy it. I uncovered ant poison in a bag with the top rolled down and secured with two clothespins. Would alarm clocks be susceptible to ant poison? Probably not. I pushed around a dozen cans of paint with labels dating them back at least 50 years. It would take an act of God to get any of the lids off, so lead poisoning was out too. There had to be a hammer somewhere. Finally, I spied a rusty metal toolbox pushed up under an old chrome kitchen table. I bloodied a knuckle trying to open it, but finally a good solid cussing popped the lid, and there was a hammer right on top. I picked up the clock, set it on Uncle Lonnie's work table, and smashed it with the first swing. It felt so good that I hauled off and hit it again. Then once more, as I envisioned Drew's face between the bells. He was still smiling, so I gave him a couple more licks for good measure.
"That clock do something to make you mad?"
Billy Lee asked from the doorway. I was wearing one of Aunt Gert's cotton summer nightgowns in Pepto-Bismol pink. My hair kinked all over my head. My bare feet were dirty from trekking out across the dusty yard, and rising blood pressure was no doubt turning my face red and blotchy. But I did not care. For the first time in my entire life, I was liberated. I pointed at him. Yes, scared the devil out of me. It won't do that again.
You don't give second chances?
He grinned. Not anymore. He stepped aside and, I guess, returned to the peace of his own home when I marched past him and into the house. I wasn't living one more second doing what society expected. That had gotten Aunt Gert a life of misery until Lonnie died. And by then she was so set in her ways she couldn't change. I had just destroyed the first thing to upset my brand new life. I was brave enough now to take Drew on. I put a Band-Aid on my knuckle and ate leftover ribs for breakfast, cold, right out of the refrigerator, licking the sticky sauce off my fingers instead of using a napkin or even a paper towel. The phone rang as I started up the stairs to get ready for church. I picked it up on the third ring. Hello? Trudy, are you still there? You will go home right now. Mother is mortified. Dad is ready to commit you. You've proven your point. You've embarrassed me. I'll be home tomorrow, and you'd best be there, Drew said. You can kiss my naturally born southern hind end, Drew Williams. I hung up. That felt even better than murdering the alarm clock had. The phone rang again, but I gave it a threatening look and reminded it that the hammer was still out in the toolbox. It stopped on the fourth ring. Guess I made a believer out of it. I held up the two new dresses hanging in the closet and decided on the red one. I liked the yellow with the Hawaiian print jacket, but I would want to wear the hat with it. And today, I wasn't covering up my hair. Not one resident of Johnston County, Oklahoma, was going to say I wore a hat out of shame for a bad decision. I slipped the red dress over my head. It was as comfortable as one of Gert's nightgowns. The jacket didn't bind me up, and the shoes felt pretty darn close to house slippers. Billy Lee was sitting on the porch when I opened the door. He wore bibbed overalls and a short-sleeved chambray shirt. Both were crisply ironed, and his shoes were polished.
You going to church? He asked.
Yes, I am.
Which one?
Same one I always go to, the one on Main Street. You?
I go to the same one me and Gert always went to, the one on Broadway Street. Thought if you were going to our church, we might ride together.
It looked like the property came complete with Billy Lee Tucker in all phases. Work, eating, church.
Maybe another time. You want to come with me today?
He shook his head so hard that if he'd been wearing glasses, they would have been flung to a far corner of the yard.
No, thank you. But it's an open invitation if you ever want to go with me.
Thanks. I just might do that someday. He followed me out to the Impala and opened the door.
You look lovely. Is that a new dress?
Yes, it is. And thank you, I said.
Red is a good color for you. It goes well with your hair.
I had a panic attack in the church parking lot. I wasn't even sure I could get into heaven if I didn't uphold the standards set by my mother. What would happen to the rich and shameless if I didn't wear black Versace and control top hose to church on Sunday mornings? Eyebrows almost hit the ceiling, and there was a steady drone of whispers, but no one brought out a rope with a noose on the end when I walked inside. Betsy wore the same black suit she'd worn to Aunt Gert's funeral, and her bleached hair had been cut. Marty wore a black sheath-style dress with a lacy jacket, and her red hair was swept up with a clip. If they had their hearts set on a new Thunderbird, they'd best call in a plastic surgeon. A new hairdo wouldn't be enough to do the trick. I slid into my normal place, leaving room for Drew out of habit. Betsy leaned over and whispered into my ear,
"What in God's name are you wearing? A new bra, panties, no hose, a dress with matching jacket, and shoes?" I whispered back.
Marty leaned past her and gave me a dirty look. She should be careful with those mean glares. A dead alarm clock could testify that I was never taking any guff again, and the hammer was in the toolbox, ready and waiting. The Sunday school director made a few announcements. The choir director led us in a hymn, and the preacher took the pulpit. He preached on about forgiveness. He was one funeral late and two cousins short. I'd forgive my cousins if they apologized from the depths of their evil souls. I would forgive Drew when he was lying in a casket with his hands draped over his cheating heart.
"Drew is going to kill you, coming to church looking like that," Marty said the minute the benediction was delivered.
"Crucify is more like it," Betsy said. "Which one of you wants Aunt Gert's house when he does?"
Marty shivered. Betsy's eyes bugged out.
"Then you'd better protect me, because I swear to God I'll leave it to one of you. You'll be sure to take care of it for me, won't you?"
I reached the door and shook the preacher's hand. He blinked fast a dozen times before he called me by name. I'm sure he was in shock, but I don't reckon it was fatal, since he didn't drop graveyard dead. I was glad for air conditioning when I got into my car and drove west through town toward the Western Inn's restaurant. I cruised past the funeral home, the H&R Block, the flower shop, drugstore, Easy Mart, a bank, clothing stores, and all the makings of a small town with a four-block business area and two red lights. I knew most of the people in the restaurant, and a few mumbled a cautious hello. They didn't want to get too close to the crazy woman, since scientists hadn't yet proved whether crazy, like stupid, is inherited or contagious. The waitress brought a glass of water to my booth and asked if I wanted to see a menu or if I would be having the buffet. I chose the buffet, so she told me to help myself. Maybelle Strong slipped in behind me as I was loading my plate with fried chicken, mashed potatoes, gravy, green beans, and hot rolls, and eyeing the fried okra on the other side. Maybelle had wispy blue-gray hair that barely covered her scalp. Her lipstick had run into the wrinkles around her mouth, and a bed of crow's feet cradled her bright blue eyes.
"Trudy Williams, you need to go home and stop this nonsense. You look like a cheap floozy. Have you lost your mind, girl?
"Gert would be ashamed of you," she said, without lowering her voice a bit.
"How are you doing, Maybelle?" "I suspect that Gert would be standing on a tabletop clapping for me this morning. That is a lovely brooch you're wearing. I believe my Uncle Lonnie bought that for you back before he died. Now, what were you saying about my state of mind?"
She turned 16 shades of red, one of which matched her lipstick perfectly. It looked as if she was going to succumb to acute cardiac arrest, but she managed to suck in enough air to keep her heart pumping. It would have been terrible if she'd dropped right there, because it would have slowed down the line and the fried okra was on the other side of the buffet. "I ate alone and wondered if Billy Lee was having Sunday dinner with some of the folks from his church. Did they tell him he looked like a dirt farmer and to go home and change his clothes?" "I didn't think so. Compared to Gert, Billy Lee probably didn't even qualify as an oddball. After lunch, I went home and changed into my new overalls and orange sleeveless knit shirt and started cleaning out my bedroom. I carefully wrapped